You're listening to Warm Winter Words, Apollo Bay WordFest Sunday afternoon event. This digital event is a collaboration with the First Time Podcast. WordFest takes place on Gadigal Bunud country, and we pay our respects to the traditional owners of this land and the lands on which you are listening, for they are the original storytellers. We hope you enjoy the full festival experience, sitting back and listening to all three of our guests today, Tony Birch, Lucy Treloar and Michael Veitch, who are all in conversation with Kate Mildenhall.
Michael Veitch is an actor, writer and broadcaster. He began his career in television comedy programs such as The D-Generation, Fast Forward and Full Frontal, before freelancing as a columnist and arts reviewer for newspapers and magazines. For 4 years, he presented Sunday Arts, the national arts show on ABC television, and has broadcast regularly across Australia on ABC Radio. Veitch is the author of 8 published books, including Flack, Fly and Heroes of the Skies, all exploring his long-term interest in the untold stories of Second World War airmen. The Forgotten Islands took him adventuring through the islands of the Bass Strait, and 44 Days explores the air defence of Port Moresby in early 1942. For the past several years, he has toured nationally with his one-man show Flack, based on his interviews with World War II airmen. His latest touring show is Hellship, The Journey of the Ticonderoga, based on his latest book and his own family history. Michael Veitch, welcome to Warm Winter Words.
Thank you, Kate. I'm feeling warm and wintry already up here in the Yarra Valley.
So excellent.
Lovely to talk to you.
Michael, I want to begin with sky and sea. We would have been down at Apollo Bay speaking, and they are such features of being down there. And they've also been, it seems, at the heart of your writing obsessions. And in your book, The Forgotten Islands, you went adventuring into the wild islands of Bass Strait. Can you share a story of your most hair-raising maritime adventure, please?
It's funny because the germ for that idea started at Apollo Bay.
Oh, really?
It was me kind of exploring some of the, thinking about some of the little rocks and the offshore islands and how many there are. And then I recall that, I think I actually made the call to the publisher from Apollo Bay to talk about the idea of the book, because I had a 2-book deal with Penguin. Those are the days. Hey, 2-book deals. And the second one was up to me. The first one was a war book. The second one was a book of my own choice. And I said, well, I've always wanted to explore the islands of Bass Strait, and I'm looking at Bass Strait now, and it's beautiful and stunning, and no one goes there, no one knows anything about it, but there are all these islands, and there are 100 islands, 100 named islands in Bass Strait, and about 200 that are just sort of rocks. In fact, well, this is the one adventure I didn't get to, Kate, walking from Tasmania to Victoria, which apparently you can do by pulling up on a little stone called Boundary Islet. Not even an island, it's an islet, and the border between Tasmania and Victoria runs right down the middle of it, and you can, in theory, walk. I could commit a felony in on one side of the rock that's not a felony on the other side of the rock.
Oh, there's a story.
But that's just one of them. I had wonderful – well, I think going on to Three Hummock Island, which is down off the south of the north – west tip of Tasmania, and these places are just paradise. They're completely undisturbed. Very hard to get to, but I managed to get to a couple of them. A couple I had to fly in by bush pilot. So Dave, my bush pilot, flying a Cessna that was, I think, going on really older than me, flying onto a beach on King Island, having done this incredible tour of a couple of the outlying ones, and I'm interested in seabirds, and there's one called there's Albatross Island, which is just white with shy albatross, and then there's another one, I can't remember the name of it, but it looks like an aircraft carrier. It's a big stack.
Wow.
It's a flat top stack of rock off the southwest tip of Tassie into the Indian Ocean, and he flew at it, and It's a huge cliff. It's like a, 100, 200 meter cliff all around. And he was heading for it at about 100 meters off the water, getting lower and lower. Oh. He said, am I in some weird suicide thing where he's going to, and at the last minute, I must have made a noise and went, oh, sorry, mate, and pulled up a little bit and skirted. And I could see the tufts of grass as we fell over them. And I said, well, you, oh, sorry, mate, I just wanted to tell you, yeah, I just wanted to check the old S strip out there to see what it's looking like now. I haven't flown here for a couple of years in this fabulous old Cessna. And then he went on this sort of this Battle of Britain sort of turn and down onto this beach and just sort of touched down onto this hard-packed sand that, you know, no one had walked on for years and years. And that was just one of my my many adventures I had down there. They're an exquisite part of Australia and a very atypical part of Australia. They're very, I describe it as Australia's North Atlantic. It's blustery and winds. Mm. Well, you know what Bass Strait can be like. Mm. Sometimes it doesn't feel like what a lot of people think what Australia actually is. It's rough and cold and wet and grey and all the beautiful colours of the slate grey southern oceans. And
tell me, Michael, you've told stories and entertained on the screen, on stage and on the page. Can you share with us what is the essence of a great story?
Wow, the essence of a great story. Such a simple question, but such a good question. And I think we story writers often forget what makes a good story. My dad, who was he only ever wrote one book in his life, which I think he regretted because he wrote every day of his life, kind of hermit, one-man PR company. Before that, he was a journalist on many major Australian newspapers. And he would always tell, two things he taught me. He insisted, one was insisting that I learn to touch type when I was about 14 years old, because he couldn't, because in his day, only the girls touch type. The girls in the typing pool touch type, and the journalists, of which there are hardly any women, they're all hunt and peck, bang, 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 which was great, but you can't look at the page at the same time. But he was a very fast, and he would always tell hunt and pecker, but he couldn't get that flow. And by the time he regretted that it was too late for him to learn, he's just old dog, new tricks. But he insisted when he realised that I could write, he insisted, right, you're going to do what I never did, learn to touch type. And he found this weird little, in a junk shop, this old touch typing course, which involved a whole stack of old 45 RPM, you're too young to remember what they are, little records, little single records, with a little orchestra, and you followed the in a book, and you just find a little string orchestra, and you concentrate on the middle line was L K J G L D S A, and then a little voice would go K, return, and then you'd have to pull the carriage back. And he insisted I do that. The other thing he taught me was that writing is a visual medium. And I said, what do you mean? Well, all you're really doing is putting pictures in people's heads with words. And I've never forgotten that. So I always, in all the stories I write, and I'm not an historian, I'm a storyteller. Sometimes I tell historical stories, but I'm not an historian. I have huge respect for historians, but I'm not one. I'm too lazy to be a historian, basically. I can't do all that really deep research. I just don't have the patience for it. But in every book that I start, I try and start putting a picture in people's heads in the first couple of lines. And I never want to go too long without something visual that people can get their imaginations around. And if the pictures are good enough, you've got them hooked. And I think that's one thing to me that makes a story that I can see in my mind, because some stories you can't. And some people are much better writing a story than telling a story. Anyone who's been to a writer's festival will actually know that.
Yes.
But a story that you can see and a story that keeps you asking questions, I think, makes a good story.
The story of the Ticonderoga is incredible. And Michael, I'll admit that it's one that has been of personal interest to me for a while. I've spent many hours down at the old quarantine station at Point Nepean. Well, I was so struck by the cemetery there as well, and that I ended up, and I found Mary Krutoff's book, Fever Ship, down at one of the shops down in Sorrento, And so I used the Ticonderoga story with young writers in grade 5 and 6 to write historical fiction. So when I saw your book and understood your connection to it, I went, oh my gosh, here's the, you know, here's the story, and I can finally read and see and feel the real story of it because you've done it so well. Tell us how that niggle of the family story finally turned into both an obsession and your book.
Well, actually, that's another great question, Kate, and it links to your previous question about a good story, because my family connection to this Ticonderoga tale, I should actually bring people up to speed. So I'm spoiler alert, but here we go. So my family connection is that the ship's doctor on this very stricken vessel that came into Melbourne riddled with typhus in 1852 was my great-great-grandfather, James William Henry Veitch, the first of my Veitches to come out here. And so my father was his great-grandson. I'm his great-great-grandson. And my father knew the story, even though he was a journalist and a storyteller all his life. He knew the story, but only in fragments. And he was almost kind of haunted by it because he was quite a sensitive sort of man. And he really felt what it must have been like for his ancestors to have made that very difficult, tragic, awful voyage. Mm. So he knew about it and told me the story. And he always wanted to write it up, but he never got around to doing it. So he told the story in bits and pieces, and it lodged with me. And when I was a kid backpacking in London, I spent a bit of time in the Kew Records office delving through the archives relating the story, but I didn't get very far with it. And it took me, you know, till a few years ago to start thinking about it properly. And I was looking for a next project to write, and it just hit me one night saying, my God, I've got to write. This thing's been sort of been rattling around inside my family for years. And it's the story of my family, but it's the story of many, many families. Mm. And the story of, you know, boat people. It's the story of migrants, of economic refugees, which is very much in the news now. So that's how it came about. So the book is a hybrid of a family story and a story of Australia's immigration and what our forebears went through. And how, and then it became the story of a bloody plague, and goodness knows.
That's just it, Michael. It's so incredibly timely, both as that tale of immigration and also about plague and contagion and pandemic. And there are so many books, it seems, out right now. I'm thinking I've just, you know, read Station 11 by Emily St. John Mandel, and then closer to home, Australian books like Laura Jean McKay's The Animals in That Country and Meg Mundell's The Trespassers as well, which, yeah, you know, is so eerily prescient. Hellship was written and released obviously before COVID, but has, yeah, this experience changed the way you see the book? And in particular, I know that you've also got a stage show of Hellship. Has it changed, yeah, the way that you'll put that on the stage at all?
I think it does, and I'm actually doing it next month, all streaming a performance of Hellship online.
Oh, wonderful.
We started this year down at the Port Fairy Folk Festival, not very far from you, and had an absolutely wonderful couple of performances down there. And then a week later, we were due to go into the theatre in Melbourne. And, of course, that was Black Friday, when Friday the 13th of March, when all the laws started to change. And we just went, no, we can't do it. And I haven't done a performance there. Had a huge tour. So next, I think it's the 22nd of August, is the first show back. It will be very different, yes, because so much has happened in the meantime, and so much pertaining to disease and our existence and the stress of being human, the frailty of being human, yes, which is what we're all being reminded of. It's, I think, everyone's innate human frailty has really been the thing that we're feeling, even though we're not really putting it into words. It's all the symptoms of it with our technology and our instant communication and our validation as individuals through social media and other things like that. It comes a simple old, not a germ, it's a virus, just an old bit of biology, comes and blindsides us to remind us we are still bags of bloody water and bone, and we are very, very susceptible. We're not made to have these long lives of 80, 90 years old. We're meant to have short lives of 30, 40, 50 years old, and we've been lucking out for a couple of centuries. But this is to remind us that this is not the way basically nature works, and we've been working against nature for so long. Mm. And this is sort of coming back to bite us and remind us that, you know, this species of yours is an ape-based species, biologically based, and you had feet of clay. That's how I feel about this thing.
Yeah, so very true. Michael, one of the extraordinary parts of reading your book is that it is just so visceral, all of your descriptions, and I felt like I was in the bowels of that ship with everything that was going on in there. I recently crewed on a yacht as book research. I was very, very lucky not to get seasick. I believe you've experienced seasickness, Michael. Is this how you could write about it so very well?
Well, yes, indeed. I have experienced seasickness, terribly subject to motion sickness. It runs in my family. In fact, my daughter, who is another literary person, she was the editor of Meanjin Quarterly for a few years, Zora Sandler. Okay. She is so subject to motion sickness and air sickness that even the smell of kerosene can make her nauseous, because she associates it with being on a plane and smelling the jet fuel as she's about to take off.
Oh, dear.
My experience was on a yacht trying to get to Deal Island. Now, Deal is in the middle of Bass Strait, a magnificent that's the premise of the whole Forgotten Islands book, an attempt to get to Deal to search out an old story I'd heard from a family friend. So my first attempt was on a yacht from Hastings. And I remember, and I was always dubious about yachts because I know I can get seasick, but sometimes I don't. Sometimes it doesn't happen at all. And I remember us taking off from with these little lovely old yachties and heading down Western Port Bay, and beer came out and the chips came out, and we're having a great chat. We're talking about the sailing and how it relates to how an aeroplane flies, which I knew more about, and we had this wonderful connection, and they're saying, this is great. I was feeling good. The water was smooth. And I looked ahead and saw it was the water was changed. The water looked different. Why? Looking and said, Clive. His name was Clive the Otting. It was like, they're looking ahead. Is that a little eddy or something? Are we near a river? Is the river coming into it? Because it's looking a little bit rougher there. And he looked at me and said, no, that's Bass Strait. That's where we're heading. And 20 seconds later, I felt the first of this room. It's a bow went down again. And then I think I say in the book, I started to throw up and didn't stop for the next 24 hours.
Oh, Michael.
And the boat broke. The mast snapped in half, and we had to limp back within sight of my goal of Deal Island. We had to limp back to Wilson's Promontory because the
wow,
unbelievably seasick. In fact, the skipper came down and sort of took another bucket away where there was nothing left. I was bringing up meals I'd had in 1994, you know. And he was looking and saying, oh, yes, you're not looking too well. People die from seasickness, you know.
Oh,
oh great.
Useful. Thanks so much for that. Michael, it's not only the seasickness, which is so visceral in the descriptions, it's also just the conditions on board in Hellship, which you paint so vividly, that the stench of the typhus, which I can't even begin to imagine. What did you draw on to get those descriptions so right?
Well, a few of the scant specific personal recollections. No one kept a diary, unfortunately, during many of these voyages, A, because many of these people were illiterate, and B, there were no biros in those days. It was all hard nibs and ink spilling everywhere, and the only person that had a bottle of ink was the captain. So there was so little opportunity for people at the time to record what they were going through. Later they gave some interviews, but not many. It wasn't it was something people didn't want to talk about. It was such a traumatic ordeal, this voyage and the aftermath. Even though it was an incredibly big story in its day, with the papers and the very new colony of, it was the colony of Victoria's first big story, really. I drew on other descriptions of what typhus is like, and it's horrible. There's a stench that comes from the lesions that develop on you in this ghastly kind of rash, which are vile and give a horrible kind of rotting smell. Even a single typhus patient can clear out an entire hospital ward, even today, because typhus is still. But back then, in the holds of this ship, were 800 mainly Scots passengers from the Highland clearances, people who've never seen the ocean before, many of them, doing this voyage that may as well have been to the other side of the world, other side of the moon, right, on the other side of the world. Many, many infants and babies and children, seasickness. The hardened crew of this ship used to pull back the covers to the holds, and would reach back and retch back with the smell coming up at night. We can't actually, thank God, get our heads around what it would have been like on a voyage like this in that time, let alone to actually have, I mean, let alone for women. I often think what women went through, particularly. There were toilets on board, but they were you had to climb up stairs, and what women wore in those days, and with menstruation, and it just ghastly. How any of them survived intact physically and mentally, I have no idea.
I read an article in the Weekend Papers about how many Australians have turned to their own genealogical research during lockdown and during the pandemic, and I wanted to ask if you could comment on this kind of hunger to understand what came before us and where it comes from.
Well, it's funny you should say that, because even prior to that, I mean, it doesn't surprise me what you say, Kate, about people going on to doing all this in COVID, because people of Anglo-Saxon heritage, when they go to England and research all this, English and Irish people are just bewildered by us Antipodeans doing this. They come, because it's not as removed from them. Often they're still in the same part of the world, sometimes in the same village. But for us, I think the removal, the kind of feeling like we came from something that was interrupted by this great geographical divide, so people want to reconnect. And I think the COVID explanation is that so many people are getting around to things they've always wanted to do because they're at home. And I think this is one of them. But it's always intrigued me that the strange juxtaposition of the distance from the physical distance to those ancestral antecedents to our desire to actually delve into it, which, as I said, intrigues the people, you know, our second cousins who are over in England somewhere, I guess, wherever you come from, they don't do that. People in England don't particularly have a great desire to explore their family heritage in the way that we do. By far the greatest proportion of people on Ancestry.com are people from countries like Canada and Australia, not necessarily from the UK or Ireland.
It's so interesting. And I imagine then this next question may be helpful for people who are doing that as well as for writers. You say you're not a historian, but you've done incredibly extensive research for this book, Hellship, and for your others as well. How do you record your research, and how importantly do you stop yourself falling down that endless rabbit hole of research, which can, I know, swallow you whole?
Oh, yes, and God, isn't the internet good for that? I think keeping your eyes on the prize really is part of how you do it. My first series of books were just interviews with fellows that had flew aircraft in the Second World War. So, and I started those The first one was, I think, came out in 2007. So that was the day, and I wasn't particularly digitally savvy back then, and I used a cassette recorder. And even then, they were getting old hat. I remember buying my, I had to go and buy a little cassette player from the shop, and I had to point out to the girl behind the counter what it actually was. So, well, what actually is this?
And I, old tech.
Very old tech. And then I'm kind of a bit raw with that kind of research. I remember starting to transcribe my first set of interviews, and then I stopped doing that because when I was writing from the transcription, it wasn't as exciting as hearing it. So I actually cut out the middleman. See, I'm also lazy, Kate. And I started writing directly from the voice I was hearing, like I was doing an interview as a journalist. A lot of people, writers, are aghast when I say that. But that visceral kind of when an old Spitfire pilot's telling me about what it was like flying at 20,000 feet and his petrol runs out and people are trying to shoot at him, and I was, when I did the interview, I was on the edge of my seat. When I tried to transcribe that and read it back, it wasn't as exciting. So I just kept that going. It was sort of one less step removed, I guess, from the source, and sort of wrote it around what I was hearing.
I want to ask you about those interviews. One of the themes of Apollo Bay's festival this year in 2020 is, of course, hindsight and foresight. And I want to ask, what did hearing those stories and listening to so many over time teach you about what those pilots remembered when all was said and done? You know, at the end, when they're thinking back over their lives, what was it that they remembered of their lives? What were the important things?
Well, the thing about having an experience like that and being an ordinary young person growing up in a peaceful country like ours was and essentially is, and suddenly you do something like go to war, and even if you do it for only a few months or a few years, if you then go on to live to your 90s, there's very few subsequent experiences that can replicate the intensity of what you did in your youth. So I often feel, and often what they went through was great excitement, great trauma, and loss, and immeasurable sadness. In some cases, some guys had a great war. It was an adventure. They didn't see too much that was ghastly. They often traveled to parts of the world they never would have. They made wonderful comradeship. But the intensity of those experiences, I found, stay with you completely. There wasn't much that these fellows forgot. I found there was a way to get it all out of them because particularly men of that generation are pretty linear in the way they look at information and the way they look at facts. You start at the beginning and you go through. I insisted in my interviews with them that we start where they were born, and I get them to tell me about their mother and their father and what their upbringing was like, what school they went to, whether they're in the country. And then I got them into a rhythm, and because I didn't let them miss out on any, because I didn't want them to skip any part of it, they felt, oh, that's how I have to go. I actually have to tell the whole thing. And often that involved a process whereby they divulged things that they had never told anyone.
Yeah.
The big story of, I've often quoted this story. I interviewed I was in his home interviewing a lovely old, everyone I interviewed is now dead. And often they'd never told them their war stories to anyone before, which is why I wanted to do it. But there's one fellow, Walter Ecott, and he lived down Werribee, around Werribee way, and I'll cut the story short, he was shot down in the Mediterranean as a pilot. He was picked up by the Germans. He was spent 3 years in a prisoner of war camp in Poland. At the end of the war, the Germans bunked out and the Russians are on their way. And so they said, well, we don't really want to be taken by the Russians either, so we'll walk. And he walked across Germany in the winter, saw terrible things, and is walking down a corridor, a cobblestone pathway, and two SS soldiers were coming the other way. His three mates had taken off all their epaulets and knew for a fact that if these Germans challenged them and found that these were three Allied prisoners wandering around, they'd be shot on the spot, no question. And he went, he came up this cobbled laneway in his snowstorm, and his mates either side said, what do we do? And he said, leave it to me. And he just went so far, he just went, Guten Tag. And this German soldier went, Guten Tag. And he kept on and nothing happened.
Oh, my goodness.
Now, his wife, Walter's wife of 50 years, was standing in the doorway of his living room, looking at me, looking at him, looking at me. And there's a pause. I'm in sweat because it's just amazing. It's like an action film, but it's real.
Yeah.
And she pauses and goes, you know what? I've been married to him for 50 years and I've never heard that.
Wow.
Well, you never asked me, love.
And that's it, Michael. You're obviously such an experienced interviewer, and that's a great example of how you got these stories from these men in particular. In your other work on radio and television, what makes a great interview?
I think short, simple questions and not being afraid to go to the simple story of what this person has to say, not trying to get too clever too quickly, and letting them speak. I've often wondered why Michael Parkinson was considered such a great interviewer, because I remember looking at shows and going, he doesn't ask anything. And someone says, yes, but that's why he was a great interviewer, because it's what he didn't ask that was so interesting, because he let the guests say it themselves. He would just point them in the right direction but wouldn't push them along that direction. He'd just go, oh, there you are. Can you tell us about that? And they feel like, oh, well, he's not pushing me, so I think I will. And it's a hard knack to get, because you often feel like you're in free fall because nothing's happening, but then things gradually start to happen. And, try and think of the questions of an interview, what you'd like to know personally, not what you think you should be asking, but what would I like to know?
Yeah.
Because that's what the audience is saying. If you have an audience say, oh, I'm glad he asked that because that's what I wanted to know, I think those sorts of things, they're pretty simple, but they get very easily forgotten, I think.
Well, something that I very much want to know, Michael Veitch, is how do you transform, you've done this a number of times already, how do you transform your stories from the page to the stage?
You have to pick out the good bits, really. With Hellship, the story of the stage version of Hellship is I'm basically playing my great-great-grandfather 50 years after the events of the where he's an old man, and he's looking back on it, having not, as we alluded to before, Kate, not having spoken about that experience before in his life, probably. In his obituaries, because he went on to become a doctor in Victoria and quite a prominent person on the council and that, because he died in about 1905 or something. No mention is made of Ticonderoga at all. He completely didn't talk about it. And so this is the construct of what would have happened if there's one night he was drawn out to talk about what had happened in his youth. So it's a monologue, but he goes into different characters. So it's picking the eye. It's picking the peaks out of the book, the peaks and troughs, and you have to miss out on big chunks of the story, of course. But there's a whole chapter on the Highland clearances that I could only give one kind of line to, sort of referencing what the Highland clearances were, which is a terrible, tragic story. But you've got to keep it to an hour. And, it's hard enough to learn an hour of monologue without
absolutely
it longer. But it's basically keeping to those coloured bits, those pictures that are the most vivid in your head when you read the story, and stringing them together coherently.
It's quite inspiring to look you know, as I've been preparing for this interview, to look at the range of different work you've done as an artist and someone working in the arts over your career. And I'm interested in how you sustain that and whether or not it was a kind of a plan, or whether you just go from project to project and see what form it takes.
Plan?
I should say to everyone that your facial expression just then, Michael, your eyebrows nearly shot through the top of my screen.
Okay, plan, as if. I've never had to answer that before, but that's a question that probably should be addressed to me by my therapist, Kate. So you're welcome. I never really had much of a plan, but I take that old broadcaster, Philip Brady, who's been around. I think he's only just retired from 3AW in his 80s, and he's been a broadcaster for 60 years, literally. And he used to say to people, "I've never done a day's work in my life," and which is kind of nice. He said, you think this is work? You think this is coming up and doing things you like?" The upside of working in the arts is usually you get to do some great stuff. Often you don't get freaking paid for it, unfortunately, but you get to do some really good things. And if you can generate your own stuff, if you've got a couple of skills in things like writing, it can be a very hard slog. But I mean, I haven't had to do many day jobs. I've been very lucky, and the cards have fallen my way. With the arts, hosting the Sunday Arts Show, the story very quickly, can I tell you how that came about? Because it's kind of...
Yes, please.
So on fast forward, because I started on sketch comedy, just happening to be at the right place at the right time at Melbourne University, and we're doing comedy reviews, and the ABC was looking to pick up a few shows to make, when they actually made television, the ABC, wanting to do some local comedy, and they picked us up. We became the D Generation. And then with that went into fast forward. And one of our good filler sketches was me, because he was very easy to shoot. It was all dialogue heavy. It was me playing Peter Ross, the host of Sunday Arts on Fast Forward, where I was this very pompous, uptight, broom handle up his bottom, sort of very rigid, high-end Sunday Arts. It sort of was wear a kind of a red skivvy sort of thing. And that's what Peter Ross was like. And it was, he was a bit cool. He was actually very good. But he had that Sunday Arts gig on ABC Sunday Afternoon for years, and he was an institution. And we used to lampoon him, or I used to lampoon him dreadfully. So 10 years or so go by, and I get a call from the from someone at the ABC saying, "Oh, look, I've put your name up to for a job, a posting at the ABC." "Oh, great. Oh, what's it?" "Oh, it's doing the Sunday Afternoon Arts Show." And I go, "Get out, pull the other one." "No, it's real." "Serious?" "Yep." "They know about..." "Nope." "Okay." So I go in the next, and I happen to know quite a bit about classical music, and I have a chat with this with Peter Ross's old producer. Peter had gone.
Oh, my goodness.
His old producer said, and we talked about the middle string quartets of Beethoven, which we both know and love. And he basically gave me the job on the spot and signed the contract. And then when someone showed him a tape of me taking off his friend, Peter Ross, 10 years earlier, and he wanted to tear the contract up, but he couldn't. So that's how it happened.
I love that. That's a terrific story.
It's true. Absolute true story.
Michael, you mentioned before already that you've had to shift, of course, with the play, that you've had cancellation of the play, and you'll be streaming it live. I also know that you were deeply involved in the Yarra Valley Writers Festival, as well as this festival, which has gone online.
Yep.
Can you tell us a bit about the need to kind of, to use the government speak, pivot in these difficult COVID times in the arts?
Well, I mean, I can talk to it a bit, but my partner, Brooke, is the person who made that happen, and she's...
Did an incredible job.
Thank you. I think she did an amazing job too, and she's the sort of person that she wouldn't quite let on what was sort of going on at the time, because I knew that she and Hanny Raisin had cooked up doing bringing a festival to where we live, the Yarra Valley, the Healesville, Yarra Glen, Warburton area, very close to Melbourne, complete like your area, Kate, ripe for a writers' festival, very near the Dandenongs and things like that. So she last year got it off the ground. It was all sailing along very smoothly. And, of course, you know what happened, what we're talking about happened. And we everyone casually said, look, we've got nothing to lose. Why don't we just try and put just about everything online? I'm Zooming 4 hours a day anyway. What if we make it a 10-hour Zoom session and see how it goes? And it was almost a whim that she did that on. And then she started planning for it. And as I was saying, she wouldn't kind of tell me what she was saying. So we'll probably just, do some Zoom sessions and things. I didn't know that it was going to be this monolithic, huge day that I was going to be the host of for the longest TV hosting job I've ever done. And I think it's still the longest Zoom session that's ever been done anywhere until someone can tell us otherwise. We did a 10-hour Zoom session and got all the writers to Zoom in. A couple were live in the Healesville memo. But as to the crux of your question, it was so important because, and it's what you're doing now, it's we can't get together in a big room at the moment. We just can't. But that doesn't mean that people don't want to connect. Quite the opposite. In fact,
of course,
to the power infinity, the opposite in this sort of crisis that we're going through. People need to connect. And thank God we have the technology to do so. And some people are saying that this format's really good. My sister, who's a writer and avid Writers' Festival goer, said, I really liked it because I'm tired of traipsing around and sitting in marquees and having to, do all the extraneous stuff. I just want to hear the writer talk about their work. And so this format, as we're doing now, goes straight to the heart of the matter. So it's an interesting thing.
That's exactly
I think
it.
We haven't been doing this, Kate. I think we're not just pivoting what a writer's festival is, but we're pivoting the essence of what a writer's festival is for some people, which is just talking to a creative person about what they do.
Indeed. And to that, we can also do our panelist questions and questions from the audience as before, because we've got some in advance for you, Michael. Lucy Trelaw, one of the fellow authors, has asked you, where do you start when writing? Is it with an idea you want to explore, a setting, a character, and does this vary from one book to another?
Oh, wow. It starts with an idea, I think, and it starts with a, getting back to that picture thing, it starts with a picture of an idea. It starts with being able to visualize something in your head, and it starts with a story. My current book actually is another Second World War book that that I put to the publisher, continuing on from a series of Australian fighting stories in New Guinea in 1942 and 43. The first one was 44 days. The second one was about the Battle of Milne Bay, a very neglected bit of history. The third one is the Battle of the Bismarck Sea, an extraordinary event that lasted 20 minutes but changed the direction of the Pacific War, and we were very heavily involved. And I can picture it happening. It was an amazing event and brutal and incredibly well planned and great feats of imagination and daring and quite spectacular. So I've got to be able to picture that to get the essence of the story.
This is a wonderful question from Jill from Bourne North, who's involved with the festival. She says there are striking parallels between the management of the typhoid epidemic that plagued the Ticonderoga and COVID today, and the Ruby Princess comes to mind. Life-threatening illness, isolation, armed forces intervention and inquiries after the event. The inquiry following the Ticonderoga's voyage sought to ensure nothing like this disaster would ever occur again. With insights from writing this book, Jill asks, Michael, might you care to muse on why we have not learnt from past mistakes?
Oh, have we not? It's hard to say. I actually think that we've actually done quite well in Australia. What we're going through in Victoria currently, notwithstanding, I think we've still done pretty well. I think in the... It all depends what your knowledge base is. Now, we're struck with a virus that we don't know much about because it's new. Now, typhus in 1852 was by no means new, but they still knew nothing about it. They had no concept of the transmission of the bacteria. They had no idea typhus is transmitted through a bacteria in lice, human lice, which everybody had then, even the rich people. As someone told me, you understand, back in those days, even the rich people stank. Back in those days, everybody had lice, and but no idea until another 50, 60 years that this was the cause of the disease. Having said that, they did their, even before the outbreak, they did their best. They washed the ship out. They fumigated it. They put all this effort into completely the wrong things. So it wasn't that their intentions were bad. They just didn't have the knowledge. And I think we're the same, and mistakes were made, and we've made mistakes. Sure, those people shouldn't have been let off the Ruby Princess. Someone in a New South Wales Health Department was probably following a directive that wasn't quite clear enough. They weren't a bad person. Yeah. The Victorian government probably shouldn't have hired a dodgy security company. Governments, state and federal, hire dodgy security companies for all sorts of things all the time because they're cheap. Yeah. No one intended it for it to happen. It was like, oh, let's take a risk here. It was like, oh, well, we'll get the company that we normally hired to do this sort of thing. Yeah, okay, what's the job? You got to keep these people in this building. Okay, well, and it all went to, all went down the drain.
That's one of the takeaways of your book is that point that you make about that the science, that there wasn't the medical understanding of what the disease was there. And if anything, what I've taken from it in reading it is thank God for the science now, that the things that we do understand, which is, you make that point too.
Yes. Well, of course, as we know, the knowledge of science is not as respected as it should be at the moment. It seems that the volume of one's opinion seems to sort of trump, literally speaking, a lot of scientific opinion. And someone, scientist, said, look, I'm sorry, but the strength of your ignorance does not match the strength of my knowledge. And it's true. But yes, thank goodness. Then, in fact, in the 19th century, people actually had far more respect for science than many people do now. It's just at the time, the knowledge reservoir was very thin compared to what it is now.
Before I let you go, Michael Veitch, I want you, if you can, please, to share with us some book recommendations that can help us as we continue to bunker down and see out this winter. Anything you've been reading currently or that you think we should have in our bookshelves?
I have just finished one of my favourite writers. He's long dead, J.G. Farrell. And he wrote a series of books called The Empire Trilogy about the decline of British power. The first one is called The Siege of Krishnapur, set in a British town in India during the Raj. And the second one is called Troubles, it's set in Ireland in 1920, all around life in a huge hotel that's gradually rotting away through bad upkeep. And that's basically the British Empire falling apart. And the last one is The Singapore Grip, about the fall of Singapore. It's brilliant, hilarious and funny. He died in the 80s. At 44, swept off rocks fishing, J.G. Farrell. One of the most brilliant books I've read in ages is The Signature of All Things. Eat, Pray, Love, Woman. What's her name?
Yes, Elizabeth Gilbert.
Thank you, Elizabeth Gilbert. It is a masterpiece, The Signature of All Things. It's just really, 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 really good. People who are interested in and it goes and it's the greatest heroine of a story I think I've ever read. It's the most brilliantly constructed central character, fabulous. And it goes into a bit of Charles Darwin stuff. And to Charles Darwin, one of the best books on Darwin I've read was written by an Australian author, Darwin's Armada, which I reread recently, about the people who helped Darwin gather everything. And that's a great story too. That's really, really well written.
Fantastic. But
people get on to J.G. Farrell, really, really good writer.
Excellent recommendation. And Michael Veach, thank you so much for sharing your stories with us today and with Warm Winter Words.
I've just loved it, Kate. Thank you so much. Lovely chat.
Apollo Bay WordFest thanks all of our authors for their conversations with us today, and also a big thank you to Kate Mildenhall for her warm and generous interviews. To find out more about Warm Winter Words, Apollo Bay WordFest, or any of our featured authors, you can go to apollobaywordfest.com. You can purchase books by all of our guests from Readings bookstores.
We're grateful for the support of Writers Victoria and the Grace Marion Wilson Trust, who made this event possible, and also to the First Time Podcast and the Colac Otway Shire. We really look forward to gathering together in 2021 under one roof and welcoming you all to the beautiful coastal town of Apollo Bay for WordFest.